War doesn't end when you leave the battlefield. The hardest fight comes after service. Identity, purpose, and tribe. Where do you stand when the uniform comes off? This is where we talk about it. No bullshit, no filters, just real stories from those who've been through it. This is the Great Guns Podcast with your host, James Scott.
Today, we have a very special guest that I've known for a while. We attended a course together, and I think he's got a great story that I think we'd get a lot of great information from, and I think it just needs to be shared. So without further ado, over to you, David. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, James.
It's good to have you on. I know we were just chatting a little earlier, just before we started. So, but for the benefit of the audience, would you mind just giving them a background of who you are and what you've done?
Yeah, so I recently retired from Police Scotland. So started my policing career in 1998, after a lot of that time with the reserve forces. You know, I'd worked in factories before. I never found my true calling. I'd always wanted to be in the police, but just wasn't getting there. So that's how I joined the reserves. Build the fitness up and build a bit of confidence. So it did me good. 1998, started my policing career and retired after 25 years in 2023. Seen a good wide variety of things. Started out rural sort of policing and then plunged into the East End of Glasgow for a number of years for the latter half of my career, which was a bit of an eye-opener. So I've been married 30 years, which is pretty amazing. Nowadays, 30 years with the same person, say two kids as a result of that as well, although there are no kids anymore. One's 25 and my daughter, she's 21. Yes, good sort of nice suburban happy chilled life. Certainly getting my life into a normal routine after policing, with a more sort of steady Monday to Friday 9-to-5 job living in suburbia.
Cool. All right. Thanks. So, obviously, you hadn't quite touched on it there yet, but your policing background, to say the least, took a bit of a toll on you. And most significantly, back in 2019, when it all obviously was brought to a head. Can you just tell us a little bit about and kind of what ended up leading to that moment, if you like?
Yeah, so 2019, I was diagnosed with PTSD and anxiety. And obviously, I'd been suffering with that for longer, but not aware of it. My wife used to say things like, you know, you've changed. You're a different person since you joined the police. I say, rural policing, all great. You know, 2008, I transferred through to Glasgow and was placed in the East End of Glasgow at one of the biggest and busiest subdivisions at the time. I don't know if your listeners will be aware of places like Parkhead, Bridgeton, the Carlton, Easterhouse, Barlarnock, you know, quite sort of, I wouldn't say deprived communities, but not affluent communities, and a lot of issues there. And certainly sort of, you know, from 2006 up to the sort of mid-teens, that time Glasgow was the knife crime capital of the UK, and certainly I think it had been described as well in 2006 as the murder capital of Europe.
Wow.
So really, really bad. And there's a lot of great work that had been done by the then Strathclyde Police under their Chief Constable, Stephen House. And I was right in the thick of that. So, you're put in a police station and the gaffers are like, well, you've got 10 years service, so there's a set of keys. There's a probationer to work with and out you go kind of thing. You know, it was a proper baptism of fire. And it was nice. I remember my first weekend shift, and it was a Saturday, and started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon back shift. And we went to a call where a student had reported their laptop stolen, but it looked like as if, you know, it wasn't a crime there. Something that, you know, and we dealt with that, and I thought, oh, that's quite low level stuff, that's okay. And then the second call was a male who'd been, it was ambulance had reported they're dealing with a male who'd been stabbed. Okay. So that was fine. I says, well, you know, and then dealt with sort of, you know, the rural side. I always dealt with sort of, you know, acts of violence and stuff like this, but this was a proper knife crime. But it happened in a house, and we gets in there, and this guy was anti-police. He's lying on the floor, yeah, and his legs are crossed, and he's lying there, and his hands are like this, you know, and he's like, get the police out of here. Don't want the police in here. And he's got two or three stab wounds in his abdomen. His girlfriend at the time was saying, because we were saying, when did this happen, you know? And he wasn't giving any information away. She said, this happened at 4 o'clock this afternoon, and it's now 6 o'clock at night. So,
yeah.
Because he wasn't wanting anything done. Didn't want an ambulance. She 2 hours persuading him to get an ambulance. And he finally relented. Yeah. So we gets into the house and we're having a look, and he was like, get police out of here. Don't want them in here, you know. So paramedics are like, right, we'll need to take you to the hospital. Right, get the police out first, you know, because we were having a good look about, you know, try to find sort of clues.
Yeah.
Bloodstained knife on the radiator and things like that. So he'd obviously had a wee bit of a set to with friends through drink, and this is what's happened, but he wasn't cooperating. So that was fine. Dealt with that. And then another one came in within half an hour. Someone had been stabbed again in a house. And so we went and dealt with that. And then the third call came in. So once that had been dealt with, it was like, boom, there's another call. And this was just a guy standing at a bus stop.
Yeah.
Elderly guy. And the young team had just came steaming along the street. And for whatever reason, they've all stabbed this guy. They've all had a shot. And it was, yeah, it was proper grim, you know. And what, I don't think we got anybody for that either. You know, they dealt with that ultimately because it was gang-related. But this guy was just an innocent victim, just standing at a bus stop. These little arseholes, who were probably about 14, 15, 16, had come running by. And, yeah, it was pretty grim. I remember the ambulance was there, and they were looking at things. They were showing us, you know, he's got a punctured wound here. There's blood frothing up. That's a punctured lung. But what stuck in my mind was his legs. And for some reason, one of them had stabbed the calves of his legs. It's like, this is just a frenzied attack on someone who's waiting for a bus.
That must take its toll on the viewer.
You just get on with it. And, you know, there's things you see and there's things that obviously stay with you. And how we deal with them and, you know, how you compartmentalise things, how you stick things away. You know, and it's the very much like the military, you've got that sort of dark humour, you know, the gallows humour of, you know, did you see that there? That was, you know, and we'll talk about things in the canteen culture, because it's good to speak about these things. But, you know, I remember one night as well, and it was, I shouldn't say it was hilarious, but there's nothing else I can describe it as. two guys had reported having been attacked in a pub in the East End of Glasgow. And it was like midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. And they were at Bridgeton Cross. Now, Bridgeton, it's on London Road. And they've got a wee bandstand in the middle. It's nicely painted and it's been renovated and stuff like that, you know. And they were, you know, there was nobody about. They were the only two people that were there. So he turns up. And there's a guy who's holding his face like this, right? And there's another guy who's on his phone, right? Aye. And he's talking away. And I'm like, who are you on the phone? And he's like, I'm on the phone to his wife, Sandra, you know? So meanwhile, he's now, because the police have turned up, the ambulance have turned up, he's like lying on the floor now, saying, tell Sandra, tell her I'm fading away, tell her I'm fading away, I'm oozing, I've been plunged. Oozing life out every orifice. And the paramedics are going, mate, you're fine. He's like, let's have a look at this, you know, and they're trying to pull his hand away from his face, right? And the finally paramedics like, tiny wee puncture wound, nothing. And they're like, aye, you're fine, mate. So meanwhile, this guy's still on the phone. He's like, aye, Sandra, listen, no, I need to go. The ambulance is there. And the police are like, aye, it's fine, I need to go. So just as this is about to finish the call, the paramedic said to him, you okay, pal? Is anything, you injured? He went, don't think so. Ear was missing.
Right.
The whole fleshy part of the ear was gone. Out. And there was no blood. Right, it was just dry. There wasn't even any blood on his collar or his neck. It was just utterly bizarre. And it's as if someone had a knife, you know, and he's went like that and it's just caught him by the ear. So the paramedic's like, right, you're worse. You need to get in the ambulance. You need treatment. And he was like, eh? So they put him in the ambulance. One of the paramedics is bandaging him up. And the other paramedic's like, right, officer, do you know where this happened? Because if we can get his ear, then it can be reattached. I was like, well, we don't know where it's happened yet, but they came from sort of that direction. Right, let's get looking for this. So I got a torch, got the torch out, and we're trying to sort of, you know, walk up the footpath, try to see if we can find this bit of ear and where it might be. And this paramedic's standing over my shoulder as I'm got the torch, and he's going, hello? 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 Can you hear?
That is, that's that kind of humour.
Absolute not, you know. We never did find that. Never did find that ear. Which is a shame, but you know, so you've got things that are really grim,
yeah,
and then you've got the humorous side of it, okay. But there's only so much I think you can take before it starts to really affect you, and it's different with, you know, everybody's different the way we deal with things, the way trauma affects you or haunts you or comes back to bite you. And I didn't see any of that, you know. I wasn't aware of being any different, because I was one of the lads, you know, response policing for, you know, 20 out of my 25 years, you know. I was one of the sort of emergency responders on the shift, you know. It was the first call sign to always be called, and it was just that, you know, you minute you heard Bravo Alpha 3-0 on the car, you were on the radio, you're like, right, this is something big. Because that was us, 3-0, first on the call sheet, like, you're the emergency response car. Like, great.
Yeah.
But it never weighed you down. You know, you're sitting in the briefing for your shift, and it's like, right, a call signs for this evening, Bravo Alpha 3-0, Davey and so-and-so, and you're like, right, you write it in your notebook. Yes, never thinking, well, knowing that you're going to get the shit end of the stick. And the radio would be constant, yeah. And it can wear you down. You get tired and fed up and grumpy and stuff like that. But I think what sort of the realisation for me was my wife saying to me things like, you've changed, yeah. And there was an incident where I was driving, right, we're going to shops. Yeah, going for a weekly shop, you know, on days off at the weekend, and I was driving behind someone, yeah, and my wife was like, she just turned to me, she says, they're annoying you, aren't they? I was like, yeah. They weren't, you know, no road rage or anything like that, but just that, you know.
Yeah, she can see you getting frustrated with it.
Yes, she could see that. She's like, that person's annoying you, aren't they? I was like, yeah. So, that was fine. They went off up a slip road, and I, you know, off it goes. It was round the corner at the next junction, okay? Because the town I live in, Cumbernauld, it's very much like, I don't know, Milton Keynes or something. It's full of roundabouts. Yeah. Yeah. So no matter what way you go, you're always going to end up at your destination. There's loads of different ways you can go, and you're, you know, you're still there. So we're turning into Tesco, and the same wee car comes round the roundabout and gets in front of us. And I was like, oh, fuck. No, this guy again. Right. No, in fact, it was before he even said that. Joanne, my wife, had turned to me and said, ha ha, look, he's beat you. And I went, that's no funny. And I proper snapped at her. I was like, that's not funny.
Yeah.
Right. And she's like, are you okay? And I was like, aye, fine. Yeah. Right. Parked the car. And she's right, see, before we go shopping, come on, get a cup of tea or a coffee and we'll sit. Because you need to calm down. And that was another thing. You need to calm down. Why? Why do I need to calm down?
Which probably has antagonistic reaction from you. You know, it's like, are you...
Yeah.
What do you mean?
You know, it was that whole... You know, what has triggered me there? And we spoke about it. And I was like, I don't know. She says, did that not go right for you or something? And I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe not. So now this leads me on to something interesting as well, because not long after that, on my birthday, a couple of months later on my birthday, Joanne had bought me Jason Fox's book Battle Scars, Because, you know, SAS, Who Dares Wins, big thing on the telly with Foxy and Ant Middleton and that. And I, you know, it's a really good show. And so she bought me Foxy's book. And so I thought, oh, that's brilliant. Thanks very much. And I'm sitting reading it. I think getting about the sort of second chapter. Because initially he's talking about himself in the military. Then he goes on to leaving and the reasons he left the military with PTSD and stuff like that. And how, you know, he felt inside and how it was affecting him. And I'm reading and saying, well, that's me. Yeah. And this bit he's talking about, I'm like that. You know, I would rarely go to social functions. And if I did, I'd be sitting up the back of the room, very quiet, just keeping away from people because too much noise and chatter was starting to wear me down. I didn't know why.
Yeah.
And so I had decided I need to go and speak to my doctor. Need to seek help. Because what I found as well is nobody's ever going to chap your door and say, I'm here to fix your mental health.
Yeah.
And yeah, nobody's ever going to do that. I think with society, we're a slightly better place because there's not so many stigmas around mental health as there used to be. And people talk about it more and there's more awareness of it and it's a lot better. And we're getting things like, you know, welfare departments and organisations, yeah, and signs and posters everywhere and signposting and leaflets. It's a lot better than what it was. So I took the plunge and it was a big step. To go to the doctor. I can't remember what I went to the doctor for, right? I've always got trouble with my sinuses, so I thought, right, I'll phone up, right, I've got a problem with my nose just now. Great. That gets me in to the doctor.
Okay, so it was your normal kind of GP that you went to first?
Yeah, it was. Okay. I'm sitting there, and he was a young guy, Dr. Rolinski. Yeah. He's moved on since, and he's away from practice, but a really, really nice fella. And I don't know if he saw hesitancy, but once he'd seen me for like maybe 10-minute consultation, he said to me, is there anything else? So maybe, you know, I was like, yeah, have you got another 10 minutes? Because I don't feel right with things going on in my head. And he's like, yeah, no worries. And he went on the intercom and he said to receptionist to get just to write me off for the next 20 minutes, you know, don't interrupt me. Great. So he's, you know, and he said, yeah, he said, you have symptoms of PTSD. He says, I'm not a medical psychologist, so I can't diagnose you. He said, but I'm going to send you, if you want, refer you to a psychologist. Would you
want that? Sorry, he said to you that he saw signs of it?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So he just originally
because I think I just went and unloaded.
Yeah.
And there was one point as well, right? And it was towards the end of me speaking to him. He stopped me and said, sorry. He said, when did this happen? Right. Because I came out with what I think was the trigger for it all. Right. And so this is 2019. And I'll rewind back now to 2009. Night shift at Glasgow's East End, and he turns up for our shift, and the sergeant was saying, giving out our pairings, you know, off of 3-0, Davey, and he says, I'm pairing you up with Nikki. Nikki was a probationer, okay? She'd already been on the shift for a few months. So she'd been with somebody for about 2 months, another cop, and she's a we're now swapping things around because that's the way, yeah, they'll do it. So 2 months, she'll be with me. She'll learn stuff, you know, how I deal with things and stuff like that. So out we go, 10 o'clock at night, out on the street. Now, because it was a Friday night, there's an overlap in shifts. So still the back shift are out and there's not a lot of cars available. So we took an unmarked police car, a little red Ford Focus, and out we go is in that, having a wee drive about the East End. Now, we just turned out the police station and we get sent to a call. And the call was a male in the street trying to break windows or smash a door. All right. So we were literally around the corner from it. And I said, we'll take that. We're in an unmarked car. because I was thinking youth disorder. Yeah, sneak up in the unmarked car and we'll catch them.
Yeah.
So drive into the street and there's a guy standing in front of us. Must have been in his 50s, shirt and tie, suit, overcoat, and honestly looked like something out of Peaky Blinders. But just without the hat. And he's standing in the middle of the street with this long Crombie overcoat on and the biggest knife you've ever seen, or I had ever seen, literally, you know, big 7-inch, 8-inch blade on this thing. And I did, you know, me and Nicky jumped out of the car at the same time and I shouted, "Knife, you've got to shout knife." And this is part of the sort of police, you know, "Knife." And I shouted to him, "Police, drop the knife." Okay. Now I heard that in my ear because Nicky's hit the red button on her radio and that's opened up the channels to everybody.
Yeah.
So they can hear me shouting. I can hear myself shouting, "Please drop the knife." And he turns round and he goes, "You can fuck off as well." Right. Game on. So, and then I think he realised, no, it is the police. And he turns round to run away. Now, I shouldn't have done this, right? But I chased him. That's, yeah.
Is that not what you're supposed to do? No, because most people would think that's your job. Oh, you got to chase him.
That's my job, yeah. Job, but bad guy, safety. Yeah, he's getting the jail. Yeah, we've got to get him. So I ran after him, and because Nicky's pressed the red button, right, it's almost like an airstrike, especially in East End of Glasgow. And you can start to hear the sirens coming. So we know there's backup coming. Now, he ran round the back of a little white Ford courier van that he'd, and we're assuming it was his because he'd get in it. And he's trying to get in this van, and I'm thinking, no, you're getting to jail. So I ran up with my baton, and I hit him, you know, from behind, right in the elbow, thinking he's going to drop this knife.
Yeah.
No, he didn't drop the knife. Okay, so he turned round and said, "You fucking bastard." And he lunged at me with a knife. Now, literally, it was half a centimetre, millimetres from my chest. Okay, I'm wearing body armour.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it was in there, or, you know, or it's a bad batch, you know, I don't want to test this out.
Yeah, no, you don't want to be testing stuff like that, no.
No, it's there for the reason, but... So, I got this... Dropped the baton, got the spray out, and sprayed him right in the face. And he still got into that van and drove off. Now, meanwhile, Nicky was round the front of the van, so she's on the bonnet. And, yeah, okay, so she was right there. Two pandas turn up, block him in. So he goes up in the footpath, and Nick had to jump into a garden. And then there was stuff happening as well, like, because you're aware, everybody's coming, the radio's going, sirens. And then I could hear someone from flat shout at the top of their voice, "He's just trying to kill a copper." So that had stuck in my head as well. Apparently, yeah, he's just trying to kill them. Okay, so later on that comes back to me. So off he goes, drives down the street, he's getting pursued, two marked cars chasing him, there's more coming, there's a dog unit, traffic are shouting in, saying, "We'll attend." So I'll... He goes round the corner and goes head on into a police car, a police van, and crashes. I tried to get him out. When we got there, there was cops pulling him out the van by the ankles. Yeah. While he's still trying to get the knife that was on the dashboard or the passenger seat. So it's like, what is that? That he was proper. He was on something. Must have been on something. And he was right up there, you know. It was one of the most violent encounters I've ever experienced in my policing career. And we got him, cuffed up, we got taken into the police station, he got locked up. And you don't have any post-incident recovery from that because, right, it's like, right, what we're doing now, he's getting charged, two counts of attempt murder, possession of offensive weapon, bladed article in a public place, failing to stop for a police, and we're loading all these charges into the system, and we're doing our custody report. It's a Friday night, that guy's going to court on Monday, and in fact, was it the Monday? It was the Monday because it was the start of the shift, so he's going to court on the Tuesday. So we sat and done our custody report all night, so we had no downtime.
Yeah.
Tuesday, during the day, it's been about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 o'clock, my phone was ringing. and it was a divisional commander that had phoned, and he's like, guys, he says, I'm just off the phone to Nicky as well, Davey. I just want to speak to you, say, you know, really well done for last night. A really hard fought incident. You know, you've done well. Got this guy off the street. Fantastic. Are you guys okay? At any time, you know, if you want to come and speak to us and we'll have coffee and, you know, stuff like that. Like, no, all good, boss, all good. And that was it. So that incident never really went away. Now, what started off with canteen talk and speaking to people about it, speaking to cops about it, on my terms, was good. I remember that night, Davey, you know. But then as the sort of months went on, if it came up in casual conversation, I wouldn't talk about it. Because it was not on my terms. I wasn't ready to speak about it. So in hindsight, that was me putting up a wall, a bit of protection.
Were you aware of that you were doing that then? Or did that only come out once you started having conversations and opening up about it?
Yeah, hindsight. Definitely hindsight. Yeah. But once we started, you know, talking about it, then, you know, you look back on these things and say, well, do you know what? I did kind of guard myself. I was very guarded. And I found myself as well, and this was a difficult thing, was becoming increasingly more confrontational with people, and to a certain extent, violent with people that I was dealing with. Now, other cops had noticed that as well and were saying things to me like, are you okay, mate? Because you've absolutely ragdolled that guy there for no reason. I was like, I really did I? You know, proper things like taking people down to the ground, putting handcuffs on too tight, you know, throwing them in the car rather than doing it. And I hadn't noticed that. But this was obviously, and with the benefit of hindsight, was, is this going to go right or is it going to go wrong? Do I need to take the first step here?
So you were almost kind of you're anticipating it going wrong because of your experience.
Absolutely. And all the training kind of not goes out the window, but you know, the police are very well trained when it comes to putting hands on people. And we speak about things like profile offender behaviour and officer response when it comes to officer safety training. And it's quite sort of well thought out, you know, and how you respond. You never go beyond what the offender is doing. It's always to count. So it's like, if somebody's compliant, the use of force continuum, as they call it, is officer presence. All right. So if somebody's compliant, officer is present, then they'll remain compliant. If they start to get into verbal threats and gestures, then it's tactical communications. So
So you're escalating as they do.
So they escalate and we respond. They escalate.
Yeah.
So, but there were some times where I was just steaming in. I hadn't really noticed it. So when you start to put these things together, that's when you realise that, okay, there is something wrong, right? So I relayed that story to my GP and he interrupted me. When I ended, he says, sorry, can I just clarify? When did this happen? Right? So this was 2019. I said, that was 2009. 23rd of May, 2009. It's like, right, he says, you've actually recounted a story like it happened last night. He says,
well, I was impressed with what you were saying and the detail.
So much detail. And I still don't sleep well at night. Okay, I'm not a good sleeper. It stinks. And my wife's quite used to me getting up in the middle of the night sometimes, you know, because it comes back, flashbacks. And with me, it comes back in the middle of the night, you know. But.
Yeah, as it often does.
So treatment to start with was quite slow, okay? But NHS is absolutely fantastic. See, when you need help, right? Whether it's a, you know, trauma, car crash, injury, sickness, NHS really step up and they're good. Despite the fact that we get terrible waiting times and ambulance response times, the pressure in NHS. See, when you need them, brilliant. And so I was diagnosed just before lockdown. So I was getting my treatment like this, face-to-face on a laptop before it was, you know, lockdown ended and we can get back in. And I was referred to my psychologist, I think early 2020 after the first lockdown. And that was a kind of pivotal moment for me, speaking about PTSD and treatment options and things like that and going through things. She'd done the EMDR, eye movement desensitization, something, you know, they get you to follow. And then she'll just stop me and say, right, where are you now? Think of the incident, where are you now and stuff like that. And there's a lot more stuff coming out. She touched on the control aspect of it and identifying with a victim. So identifying with a victim, she said, you feel sympathy and empathy and remorse for the fact that you survived. Survival guilt?
Yeah. Often people with survival guilt feel almost like they have that victim mentality.
Yeah. And she says, and that's why you're probably overreacting sometimes to things. Because you've seen yourself as a victim. This man tried to kill you, but it didn't happen. But you have seen the victims of crime, you know, through knife crime, serious assault, murder. You've seen all that and the impact it has on not just the victim, but the victim's families and things like that. The whole court process and, you know, because you've got an insight into that. He says, you've put yourself in that position of you have survived survival guilt. Oh, wow, okay, very interesting. He says, then control. He says, there's a lack of control with this incident and you lost control. I was like, pardon? She says, I don't mean you lost control and you overreacted, but you speak about profiled offender behaviour and police response to that. You go to things and 99 times out of 100, you went to somebody's house or dealt with something in the street. Yeah. Because the police are there's no resistance. When you say to somebody, you're under arrest and you put handcuffs on them and you put them in the police car and you take them to the police station, you interview them, do that whole process, everything goes right. But on that occasion, your mindset of things going to plan, that incident never went to plan. He didn't drop the knife. You chased him. If you couldn't apprehend him, he fought back. He turned the knife on you. He then got into a vehicle. He said, nothing went right. And it went out with your control. Because it's like suddenly, hang on, the police have turned up. That should have stopped the incident. You've chased him. You should have caught him and that should have stopped the incident. But it didn't, and it continued, and it continued, and it continued. And in the last aspect as well, you've heard this voice from across the street shouting, Mom, he's just trying to kill the police. She says, that's got to stick with you, and that has stuck with you, and that's how you're remembering these things. It's like, wow, you know? So, yeah. And I think people associate PTSD with the military, and I'm quite critical of TV programs that portrays veterans with PTSD as angry loners that are going to flip a switch and commit a crime and kill people. Because you see it in these programs, don't you?
Yeah. And people often believe it, that is reality, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, because it's war zone, you know, and the guy with PTSD is portrayed as a farmer who's got a shotgun and he goes out and, you know, it's like, sorry, what are you doing? And I think the image with the public is people with PTSD can be dangerous. They're always ex-military, and it's not always military. You know, I read Jason Fox's book, and he talks about battle fatigue. And that was his title, Battle Scars. Mm. Well, he was fighting a battle, not just a physical battle, but his battle with PTSD. Now, could I align myself with that? I'm not sure. Was the East End of Glasgow a battle zone? At times it was.
Kind of going back, just when we were talking before we started, was that whole, it's the way you perceive a situation and a scenario and then how that affects you. That's what brings on the PTSD. Like you're saying, it doesn't always have to be military. It can still be the effects and the cumulative effects of seeing continued violence or paramedic, the aftermath of violence. It's that constant seeing that builds up, and if it's allowed to build pressure, when we say snap like that, we don't necessarily mean that, like you just mentioned, that someone's going to snap and become It just means that they can't control it anymore. They can't control their feelings anymore.
Yeah.
So I would have thought you could align it with PTSD, but not under the current public portrayal of PTSD, that you're a hardened war veteran and you've been there and done that, and now you've got the scar.
Yeah, the brooding guy in the pub that's sitting in his pint, you know, looking at people, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you know, that's the tick the box for, you know, ITV, BBC dramas, isn't it? But you know what, a certain aspect of that is correct. A certain aspect. Now, before I left policing, I was doing counter-terrorism work with the business community, you know, going out to businesses and talking about counter-terrorism incidents and, you know, empowering them to look after their own premises and stuff like that, you know, especially like nighttime economy and events venues in Glasgow and Edinburgh. Now, I was in an office and we're just having a meeting over coffee, and it was with another cop who was an inspector. And see, once we'd done, he's like, "Are you okay, Davey?" I was like, "Yeah." This was around about, this was 2017, 2018, I went to counterterrorism. And this is a lead up to me going to the doctor as well, stuff, you know. He's like, "Are you okay, mate?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, you seem easily distracted. He said, "Your head is constantly on a swivel." He said, "You're looking at everybody coming in and out of the building." Excuse me. I hadn't noticed that, but apparently, I was, and looking back now, yeah, I was. Everybody that came into my eye line, I was looking at them. And if they've got a lanyard on, brilliant. Excuse me.
Yes.
Sorry, I've had this cough for a week now, and it just dries up and it catches you.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's talk all week anyway in my job now, you know, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. I'll touch on that in a minute. Yeah, I was looking at everybody that came into my eye line, you know, hypervigilant. And it's like, you got a pass on, they're fine. And I'm back to, into the meeting. I hadn't really noticed it, but, and the guy, he was ex-Royal Navy. And he's like, "You're looking for threats there." "No, I think you are." He says, "Every person that came into your site, you were looking at them." "But I don't do that now. I don't." Mm-hmm. My wife said that as well. She said, you know, we're going for coffees and stuff like that. She says, "Now you don't bother with people. You were always..."
And it's that hypervigilance that you have all the time, is if from a mental state point of view, having that, being at that constant heightened, it's not good for you. We're not designed to be like that. We are, to a certain extent, like, we're always aware of what's going on around you, but to have that, you're always looking for a threat. That's got to compound whatever else is going on underneath. That's just going to put more and more pressure on it.
It was like when we were on that Healthy Minds course, and they talk about the chimp brain, you know, the primitive part of the brain that says fight, flight, or freeze. It's that. I mean, it's a policeman in me as well. It's like, right, what's he up to? What's that person up to? You know, you're always doing that anyway. But yeah, so is it like the military? To a certain extent, yes. You're being exposed to traumatic incidents, whether it's, you know, daily or weekly or monthly or whatever, you're still being exposed to that. And it's the same with the emergency services, you know, the fire, police and ambulance are, you know, things that they see and deal with is just bad. And there was one incident, and it really, really resonated with me, really shook me, was a car crash, right? 11 o'clock at night. Yeah, these things usually happen, you know, midnight. Young guy took his dad's car and with his pals at a party, let's have a shot at dad's car. And there was five of them in it. And whatever they were doing, that car ended up crashing and was on its roof. Now, when we got there, we didn't even know what kind of car it was. If you've ever seen a car upside down, it's really difficult to identify what it is. It's just bizarre. It's like, what the hell is that? I mean, break, make, model, you know, it's like, you know, it's a car that's upside down, but it's like, what kind of car is that again? And there was five people standing outside, five kids, and they were all, you know, crying and screaming and stuff like that. And they were saying somebody's still trapped in the car. So the only way I could get in the car was the boot. So the boot was open, the hatchback, and I'm climbing in, trying to get to this guy who is strapped into his seat and he's upside down. And the next thing was a paramedic putting his hand on my shoulder and said, I didn't even hear the ambulance coming. Right.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So focused on. Paramedic grabbed me by the shoulder and said, just leave him, mate. He's dead. Like, what? He had a massive head injury. The traffic cops later on, when they come to do their accident report, said, yeah, you could have put your hand in that wound. It was that big. I hadn't seen that. Yeah. So that stuck with me as well. You know, that's a traumatic thing. But we're in a much better place nowadays to deal with things. And I'll say this on my first aid courses. So I'm with the Red Cross now.
Yeah.
This is another thing. This is my third job since retiring from the police.
Okay.
And because this is a very American thing, though, isn't it? You're a law enforcement veteran. We don't say that in the UK. It's like, oh, retired police, you know, ex-police.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but you're a veteran, I suppose, a veteran of law enforcement.
Well, after 25 years.
Yeah.
And everything you've seen and done, yeah.
So, if we think guys in the military coming out after, you know, their 10, 12, 20, 25 years, 30 years in the military, you know, coming out into Civvy Street, let's find a job. What job gives you that excitement, that routine, that level of camaraderie, support, excitement, adrenaline, all that stuff? And I find it difficult as well, coming out. I took 6 months off. Yeah. Finished my police career in June 23. Didn't get my first job until January 24. Because I thought, no, I'm taking, this is my time. So,
which is good.
Went to work at Glasgow Airport as a security officer. You know, doing the pat down as passengers coming in. And I lasted 3 months. It was like,
yeah, I couldn't imagine that.
Nah.
After what you'd done.
No, you know, is this your bag? You know, that kind of thing. Is this your bag? Well, what's this? Dirty one underwear and stuff like that. Some people are filthy.
Yeah. But we don't need to go down that road.
So I was like, nah, this isn't for me. So I left that. Got a job as a chauffeur. I ended up back at the airport again because they had a contract with the airport. Now, that was okay. Got to drive some nice cars, meet some interesting people. The pay wasn't the best, but sometimes you got a good tip. And it was just, there was no dramas, but it was just like, and then August, September, just last year, a friend of mine who's in the Red Cross said, there's a vacancy, somebody's left. That'd be ideal for you as a first aid instructor. And I was like, yeah, okay. So applied for it, got the job, and this is what I do now. Monday to Friday, 9 till 5. Either go to a venue or a training facility or go on site and deliver first aid training, first aid at work. And it's brilliant. It's absolutely fantastic.
And it's, again, it's a role of service.
It is. Yeah. Because you're...
Which police is a role of service. You're serving the community. You're serving, you know. So I can picture... And just from when we've met and that, I could see... I could even that short time, I can go, yeah, I think it would be good for you. I could picture you doing it. Like, do you know what I mean? I did see the photo of you with your lanyard on, and I think there's a poster behind you. You made some comment about it.
Yeah, I took a selfie.
When I saw you that, I thought, yeah, that's right.
I took a selfie and I put it on Facebook of, yeah, I just started my new job. And people were like, I didn't think you were that old. Look at the back of your head. Because people thought it was a mirror. Because it was a poster of a first aider with a white polo top on, with the Red Cross at the back, and they could see the back of the head in glass and white hair. I'm like, oh, you've aged, mate. I was like, it's a fucking poster.
Yeah.
But, you know,
but that's good. And it sounds like you've kind of found your spot now.
It is.
Good. But that's because you've done the work as well, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's something for... You know, ex-forces, veterans and stuff like that is, it's going to be difficult, you know, going out there and trying to find something that's going to give you that level of adrenaline and comradeship and stuff like that, you know. You're never going to get that. You're not. So you have to find something you're going to enjoy.
Mm.
And you'll find it. You know, and I think Foxy in his book talks about, you know, he left the military because of PTSD. They're like, sorry, it has to end your career. And a mate gave him a job in a factory or something, on a, you know, in an office, and he didn't enjoy it because of that. Sort of, you know, he missed that excitement kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very similar to, like I said to you earlier, I've just read the Dean Stock book, that Relentless, again. And he, exactly the same. They go, oh, well, come work in, I think it was construction or property development.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like going into an office and he's like, what is this? Like, no, yeah. This is not, it's not fulfilling him. And it took him to then take on a massive cycling the Pan American Highway, which is planning and preparation and training and relentlessness.
Yeah.
And that's where he found his thing that he enjoyed. And it's like you were saying now, like.
I think it is that fulfillment, definitely, and finding your purpose. You know, I've just done 4 years with the Army Cadets, and that's taught so much more about me as well. You know, it's, you're dealing with kids, and it's a great organisation, you know, 12 to 18-year-olds coming in from various backgrounds, and essentially at times putting them out of their comfort zone.
Yes,
and
yeah.
I've always said to them, there's no such thing as can't. It's always, how can I do? And I do adventure training with them, put them up the climbing wall and stuff like that, you know, do obstacle courses with them. And it's like, oh, I can't do that. No, you can. I'll show you how to do it. And we'll do it together. We'll do it as a team. Yeah. And that, I think that brings you on to the resilience as well. Kids have got amazing resilience because they've got that no fear. They're in that sort of little age where it's like they just do things because, yeah, it's probably run about the woods, bang, 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 bang. Building a, you know, building a basher up and eating ration packs and stuff like that. It's bogging for them, but it's exciting for them at the same time.
Yeah.
And we'll speak to them about, you know, resilience to carry on. You know, you're doing your Duke of Edinburgh Award and we're going up this hill and it's, yeah, we just keep going. We don't say to them like, oh, come on, man up and stuff like that. We don't do that kind of stuff. You know, I'd be teasing a wee touch, but it's that, do you know what? See if you can do this. That's something that you've never done before. You get to the top of that, and I always say to them, always look back at where you've just came from. Look at that down there. That little farmhouse that we walked past half an hour ago. That's tiny down there. You've achieved. Oh, yeah. Like, right, you can do that. Then we can get to the top. Now we get to the top, we're going to look over again. Do you see how far you've come?
Yeah.
So I think that plays a big part in mental health, definitely. And I always say as well to my delegates when I'm doing first aid, and there is a slide comes up at the end that talks about, you know, the Red Cross has a support mechanism for anybody that's done CPR, you know. And I always say to them, listen, always think of your mental health for anything. Because some of the first aid incidents, dependent, because we've got guys with factories that are dealing with people that get injured and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Hopefully the worst thing you're going to deal with is somebody who's tripped up or is a paper cut. But in the event that you have to do CPR, in the event that you have to, you know, bandage a pretty traumatic injury or deal with something, please think of your mental health. Talk to people about it. Don't sit and fester. Don't compartmentalise things. Don't let it sit for 10 years like I did. You know, I'll say I struggled with PTSD. Don't say I suffer from it. I now say I live with PTSD, or PTSD lives with me.
That's good. Yeah, that's good. I like that. It lives with you because it says that it's not controlling you.
It's not.
It's there.
I'm in charge of it. And there's times when it comes that bites you in the backside and it chaps on your, hello, I'm still here. Yeah. This wee guy here, Milo, who's just like, what do we want, an hour? He's had an hour's sleep. Yeah. This little guy has been brilliant for me with PTSD because he's got PTSD to a certain extent. He's a rescue dog and he's had trauma. He has had a mistrust of, you know, certainly men. He was rescued from a gypsy site, and so he doesn't like caravans, doesn't like vans, wouldn't walk past them in the streets. A lot better now than he was. But I am more concerned about him when I'm out than concerned about me. Yeah, so he's my shift in focus. Who rescued who? Maybe a bit of both.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. You've covered about if you're feeling the pressures and your own mental health and stuff to go and talk to people. I just wanted to go back slightly before we finish off here. Was you mentioned a few times that your colleagues saw things in you and it's like, you're right. And
yeah,
questioned behavioral changes. What advice would you give to somebody who is seeing that in a colleague? So as if they're seeing, for example, they're seeing you, you know, is it enough just to go, are you right, mate?
Yeah, when I think
they can clearly see there is a problem. What advice could you give them to help that colleague or that friend or family member even?
It's difficult. Okay. I think it's the right thing to do is to challenge people and say, is everyone okay with you? How are you getting on? Because we do say that to people anyway. How are you getting on? I've not seen you for a while.
Yeah. And everyone just goes, yeah, all fine. Right.
Yeah. So how are you really? How's the job going? You know, and take not necessarily a deep dive, but a bit of a plunge into, is there any trouble in you? How is that job? Because I remember myself, and if we bounce it back slightly to us to say, this is my experience, that person's more likely to say, oh, yeah. And realise that there might be something going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
It opens that door, you know? You know, if you put it back on yourself just to say, listen, because with me, this is what's happened, and I felt like that. How about you? How are you? Yeah. I mean, you're always going to get that one person's like, no, absolutely fine. All good.
No, sure. But hopefully then it's a case of they go away and they actually think, shit, that's the second time someone said something to me, or the third time someone said.
It could be.
And maybe it just, like you were saying, you were reading Foxy's book and you went, that's me. Oh, hang on, maybe there is something.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
maybe that's, yeah, I like that. Push past there, because we all do. We go, you're right, mate. And they go, yeah, I'm fine. And then it's a case of going, yeah, but how are you really?
Yeah.
Because we never do that with anyone. Yeah. It's that superficial, how you doing? Hi.
Yeah.
And done. So I like that. Yeah, I think that's sound advice. I like it. Yeah.
Grabbing a cup of coffee with somebody, you know, cup of coffee, cup of tea, sit, listen to my chat, you know. It's all good. Things like this podcast are absolutely brilliant. The things, the resources that are out there, and it can be difficult to find them sometimes. Both you and I have done the Healthy Minds course for the Army Cadets, which is fantastic. But that last day when we did the Mental Health First Aid in the Workplace, it's a brilliant course. If you know anyone in your workplace that is a mental health first aider, talk to them. It's a difference between, like I said, nobody's going to come and chap your door and say, you're not well and I'm here to help. But we're getting a step further to that, getting a step closer to that now with people in the canteen that, you know, you could be having a chat and they'll say, do you know what? Why don't you go and listen to James's podcast, Great Guns podcast, and you might learn something about yourself. And that just might be that little moment. And that's all it takes.
Well, that's like I said that before, is exactly the purpose of it, is that somebody listens and goes, shit, that's me.
Or
there is a way out of this. You know, this is what someone did. And then they just steps over that line and pushes them to go, maybe I do need help, like you did with the doctor going, listen, I need to talk to someone.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with it. Like you say, it's become more mainstream that we talk about mental health and things, and I've seen it, just like you were saying earlier about with the cadets and stuff, I've seen it in kids where I've gone, something's it's not quite right there, and then I can keep an eye on them, and then you realize actually, and then something comes out of the wash and you're like, yep, I thought so, and then it's being dealt with, or you know, you've signposted to someone and gone, listen, they need to talk to, and it's great because now there's a awareness of it, and I think if more people were aware, would have less issues. People wouldn't find themselves in the dark as much, I don't think.
And that's the thing, the darkness sometimes, you know. Use your darkness as a plant. Yeah. The roots of a plant are buried in darkness, only for it to grow. That's quite prophetic, isn't it? To grow and break through the ground and shoot towards the light and become a big, you know, beautiful, massive tree, plant, fruit. Yeah. Absorbs the sunlight and helps the world. Underneath, in the darkness, still dirty and grim, the roots are still in the dark, but it's providing that light and warmth to itself and feeding.
So, yeah, I like that. I think it's David Goggins. He talks about using your darkness as like fuel and fire and energy, and anything negative, you use it to push yourself to like embrace the haters and things like that.
Yeah.
Talking about all that kind of negative energy, goes embrace it. Just take it on for what it is and use that to go out, push beyond and achieve something amazing. You don't wallow in it. Don't allow it to consume you and take you over. Yeah.
I've noticed as well, when I'm going to work, so I'm driving into Glasgow, and you get to a point where you come off the motorway onto the next motorway and it's just stopped for a mile, 2 miles, and it's just, first gear. See if somebody indicates they're wanting in. I'll let them in. Yeah, because you see people, and you'll see it as well on the motorway in heavy traffic. Somebody's indicating, and this, you know, somebody jump, you know, it's like, you're not getting in front of me, you should have got in earlier, be better prepared. Do you know what? We're all on the same journey, we're all going to the same place.
Or someone is 10 cars behind you, and you indicate to pull out into that lane, and then they speed up to close the gap, and then effing blind you because you pulled out.
Like, what are you doing? I know.
We're all going in the same direction. Just look ahead of the road and see what's happening.
Aye. And just, you know, and that becoming that sort of mellowed, better person, you know, because you don't know what's going on. And also it sends a wee message out, right, is don't put yourself through trauma that might not happen, okay? So, I'm going to be late, and I'm going to have a shit day, stuff like that, yeah. And then you get to work, and that shit thing hasn't happened. You haven't been late, you've got to work on time, but you've put yourself through that for no reason.
Spreads your cholesterol, your cortisol levels, your adrenaline. It's stress that you don't need.
Yeah.
And then you will have a shit day because you've self-fulfilled that prophecy.
Yeah, you've given yourself that. So just, don't be happy. Yeah, man, relax, whatever. But just go, you know,
well, they have a lot less stressful life, don't they?
No, yeah, true, apparently.
But no, I get what you're saying, 100%. Oh, well, brilliant. Thanks very much. And I've really enjoyed the chat. It's great to hear another story and about someone that's gone through a process. And like you said, it lives with you. So you're controlling it and you're moving it forward.
Yes.
And I think that is a great thing for someone who might be in that stage, is going, well, actually, do you know what? Yeah, I've got that. I've been given the diagnosis of, say, PTSD, but it doesn't have to define who I am.
Correct.
So, and I can, it lives with me, but it doesn't control me. And I really, really like that. So, yeah, thank you very much.
No, you're welcome, mate. It's good to catch up with you.
Yeah, the same. And yeah, good luck for the future. And I really hope you,
thank you very much.
Keep going with first aid training with Red Cross and hopefully I'll catch up with you in the hills and the mountains of Scotland, as
you
we were talking earlier.
Oh, yeah, because that's what
we need to do. Thanks very much. Yeah, we'll wrap it up there.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
That's a wrap, folks, and a big thank you to our guest. Remember, keep moving forward. The fight's not over until you decide it is. Till next time, stay bold, stay fearless. Live life like it's too short for half measures. This is the Great Guns Podcast, signing off. Remember to subscribe to join our tribe.